Charles Byron is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program, sponsored by the Concord Historical Commission. The interview is taking place at his home at 173 Hubbard Street on October 13, 1977. Mr. Byron is 67 years old. Mr. Byron, you are a third-generation Concordian, your parents and grandparents having lived here. Is Byron Street named after your family?
Yes, Byron Street is named after my grandparents, and I do not know what year it was. And I understand my grandmother named it Love Lane. She put she built a two-family house on it and named it Love Lane. The other end, Sudbury Road end of Love Lane, there were a few buildings. One, Herbert Neely, had a carriage painting shed, and Mr. There was also a blacksmith shop. On Sudbury Road, there was another blacksmith shop, Mr. Moreau, and the other end of that building, a wheelwright shop, owned by a man named Mr. Milbury, who used to stop there and watch him put on new spokes and rims on the wagon wheels.
As a child, do you recall roaming the woods like many have?
Yes. We didn't have too much to do those days, so we did a lot of roaming through Lake Walden, where the old railroad station used to be in that area, and the picnic area across the railroad tracks. We had, in the fall, and late fall, we set out traps and did the trapping, and there was only one drawback. I could never bring myself to skin an animal, so I had to pay somebody else to do it, but we did hang the hides in the chicken house that we had in the backyard, and people that owned those woods were always glad to see us picking blueberries and things like that, and there was one family outstanding by the name of Shaw up in Mashotuck Hill, and that place was not built up at the time, and if anybody got hurt on the sled or toboggan, they went into the Shaw's house, and Mr. and Mrs. Shaw gladly gave them first aid and hot chocolate. On the other end of town, there was a family by the name of Adams, which had a large house with white pillars and facing the Sudbury River with a large lawn, and we used to go down there on bobsled and then also skied in that area. My children had really gone down there to make pass the ski at the time, because we didn't have the skis that they have today. When I started skiing, we had barrel stage with rubber bands made out of old tires, which was 375, which is almost as large as a truck tire today. But they supervised the young people, and they appreciated the woods, and there wasn't any problem at all. And those are the two outstanding families that I know of that contribute to the good living that we had at that time.
Your father had a grocery store in town?
Yes, he ran a grocery store at, the old number was 11 Thorough Street, and he after working at Murray's store, which was on the mill dam where the barber shop is now, he worked for a fellow by the name of Frankie Cutler, and Cutler had a store where the Concord Packer store is now. And those two, there was two blocks up there, and they were owned by the Gatti family. And in between, where the Concord Concord Auto Parts is now, that was a bushy area, and it wasn't even, there wasn't any buildings on it at all. Matter of fact, one day we were up there, a deer came over from the cattle show area and jumped over that fence right in front of everybody. And now that the, what was later built to, had an Essex Hudson dealership there, Tom Hollis, which was a son-in-law of old Dr. Tickham, which everybody knew at that time. And so my father had that store, and
people would buy general groceries from him?
Well, it was all grocery lines, but we'd have to, coffee came unground, and in the beans itself, tea came in different names, like oolong and things like that, and some people would want a quarter of a pound of this and a quarter of a pound of that, and you put it in a bag and shake it up, and that's how they had it. And then I remember helping my father grind coffee. I had to, being so small, I had to stand on a wooden box to take the wheel around. And before the World War I, he had two men working for him, one Patrick McPhillips and the other John Ryan. Both of these men were drafted in World War I. My brother William, which was taken out of school to take and deliver orders, as in the days each store had its own route, and in one each section of the town, and the in that way would have to pick up molasses jugs and kerosene cans and vinegar. It was a bottle with a woven rattan around it, and some of them used to call them Jimmy Johns, and then it returned to the customers the next day filled. And I was about 8 years old at the time. Every morning early, I would get up and go to a barn down on Thurlow Street to feed the two horses, and then put the harness on them and pitch them to the team, and then bring them to our house, and my father would take them to the horses to the store. The barn was where Walden Terrace is now, and this barn was moved and made into a two-family house next to the Mr. Toomey. Mr. Toomey was John Sheehan's grandfather. And I remember one time coming back from Old Bedford Road, headed towards Bedford Street, and the snow was so high and drifted in that area, that through the open fields, that we couldn't go any further than the next house. And we telephoned my father, my brother and I, that George the horse was steaming, which was from the spiron, and we were afraid that it collapsed. So I said, we're at a house now, and I told him the name of the house, and I said, we're going to stay all night long. So the people gave us hot chocolate and something to eat, and said, we got a bed for you upstairs, and neither one would leave the horse. So we stayed till the morning, until the streets were cleared off just a little bit, and we headed for home, and it was quite a night for us. But we had a little different feeling for animals those days, because the fact is that we used them also for carrots Sunday, right around and before cars were available around here.
Was there a firehouse on the same street near your father's store?
Yes, the AAA market is now, there was a wooden firehouse, and that firehouse, I don't remember the year, but it was sold and moved over to Wilson Lumber and used as a paint shed, which is off on Love Lane. that area in there, beyond that, on the corner of Middle Street, was McManus's stable. And when I was small, people delivering goods from Boston area or Waltham would unhitch their horses and get fresh horses and go as far as Littleton or Groton and pick them up on the way back. So those were housed in that area. The other, behind that, was a greenhouse owned by the name of a family by the name of Wheeler. And across from Friendly's, there was a turntable. I do not remember, but my father used to say that he used to help the trainman turn the freight engine around and head towards Boston. And of course, this was what they call the Fitchburg Division of the Boston Main Railroad. Mm-hmm. And of course, I haven't been down there lately, but that hot top was there for years, and we used to dive off the pillars of the old railroad station down to Lake Walden. The other area through there, I remember that there was grain sheds that Brown and Grain had there. Of course, a lot of cattle at the time, and also horses, and the horses were the mainstay of transportation back and forth. I've seen a lot of changes up through there, and of course, as I said before, that Mr. Milbury and Mr. Moreau had a blacksmith shop there. That's where the Stop and Shop, the entrance of Stop and Shop, is now. So that was our way of finding something to do, is going around watching people.
Yeah. Your present house was lived in by your parents and family, and that this was part of the Ebenezer Hubbard estate.
Yes, it was. And I understand that there was only two houses across the street, and that was the end of the street. And Ebenezer Hubbard had sold this land. They had moved his house from where the church is now, down the end of Hubbard Street, and that house still stands, going old Route 2, what they call the old Hagerty House on the left-hand side after the old Route 2. And this, the land behind this lot, evidently they decided to try to put a street through on the back end, and it never materialized, so they sold the lots all the way down the street as a full lot. This was the first on this side. In the back lot on Thurlow Street, my grandmother's brother, by the name of Terence Byrne, lived there with his father. The result was that when they could not build a road through there, which would come out on the other street down there, they combined the lots. Dr. Emerson wouldn't sell. And during that time, the playground ended way down, let's say, three quarters down from Thurlow Street. And there was a rise there with wild cherry trees, and the land was not flat. The brook ran halfway through that and took a right and came out and went underneath the Everett Street, and during World War One, having horses, we did the plowing and the harrowing and the cultivating. So all the families around here had war gardens, and we got the water from the brook, which you could see very easily because of so many willow trees along that area. Later they put a culvert through there and flattened it out. But after World War One, one day my father came home and we were mowing the grass down there, and he informed us that that wasn't our land and we shouldn't touch it. It belonged to Dr. Emerson. So Morris McWallen and I, it's just passed away since we went up and saw Dr. Emerson. And Dr. Emerson said gruffly, "No, leave it alone." So we said, "Well, he's kind of gruff. I guess we forget about that." But the following day, his hired man, Mr. Coulton's, came down, and he had everything to cut the hay and hay rake and everything else. So we went down and helped him. And so he said, "When it gets higher, I'll come down and do it again." And we said, "Well, there's no need of that because we all have lawnmowers and we'll take care of it." And we thought that was quite the thing because we didn't expect that we'd have a ball diamond because the older fellows, they monopolized it all the time and we had a problem. So we played ball down there, and when Dr. Emerson died, he left it to the town with a stipulation that it should be used for a playground, and under no circumstance any admission should be charged for that. And later they put the tennis courts down there, and they have really used it. And when I have a little garden down back, I always stop and watch the children and playing out there, and they never unruly at all. And then I also think of the time that the parents of some of them put, the time they put in teaching them on the little league baseball and things like that. And these are, and also mothers and their dogs, they go over there and they really enjoy it. So I think that he's been fully repaid for being so gruff, but he was very nice. He was a gentleman. To think that he'd be able to pass on good times to other people as the town grew older.
Can you describe the confines of what was considered Hubbardville and what was considered Herringville?
Well, there's Willow Street. We always call this the end of the street, Hubbard Street Extension. And then from that, it hit Union Street, which ran across to Fielding Street, and in the middle was Willow Street. And I was born on 4 Willow Street. And we moved to this house after my grandparents died. And I remember sitting in this room, and this was their bedroom, and this is where both of them died. They had the 50th wedding anniversary. And being superstitious, older people, I think some of us still are, somebody gave my grandmother and grandfather a golden cage with a bird in it, you know, a canary. And she said, "Well, that's bad luck. None of us live much longer." And that's really what happened. My grandmother went first, my grandfather went afterward. We moved over here in the 20s, and I remember World War I because the fact was that Route 2 went right through the center of Concord, and about halfway through, we used to watch the people going around there. But after my father died in 1928 in the same room from a cerebral hemorrhage, he was never sick a day in his life. And we had they might call it a bug today that went around. It was really pneumonia. It wiped family after family out. And none of us came down with it at all. But I remember that every day my mother would take a piece of camphor ice and replace it in a bag. And we had camphor ice hung around us at all times. And I always, if I smell Vicks vapor rub, it always reminds me of the fact that you know, that's what happened. So my father died in 28, and my mother hired a cottage down in Scituate where a sister from Wellesley lived in the summertime, and then that fall bought a place. And when we first got married, my wife and I lived here because there were so many rooms in the house, you know, 11 bedrooms. And
so this is technically Herring,
No, this part was called Herringville. Am I getting off the subject?
No.
Then after my mother died in 1941, I purchased it from the estate.
Mm-hmm.
But in this area, they call it Herringville.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a baseball team, Herringville. Why they called it over the tracks, Fairhaven Road and Potter Street, that was called Hubbardville. The other part down towards Bruick's, Old Bedford Road, that was called the East Quarter. And that's they had ball games, ball teams and things like that represented that group. And they're hardworking farmers. And now the Merriam House, in that Merriam House, that I remember two generations of Burks living there. And it doesn't seem right in the history of it to just call it the Merriam House when there's two generations of Burks that lived there. And Mr. Burke, the old gentleman's, which was the grandfather of Nancy Burke and Tommy Burke, wife was my grandmother's sister. And as a young girl, my grandmother worked for the Emersons, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And the fact was that after she got married, the Emerson, I got in touch with her and asked if she'd want a baby carriage. They had a baby carriage that they used between the Alcotts and the Emersons. They had no further use for it. And very few working people did have a carriage for the babies. So my father was wheeled around in the same baby carriage, Louise May Alcott and the Emerson. And we did lose it because the fact was my aunt had lived here and she bought a house up on the corner of just where the Main Street takes a left off of Elm. And she passed away up there in 1927. But the fact was that these people that had lived here didn't intermarry, but they spread out around because Waltham was quite a ways from there. And I know my mother's grandfather was a foreman. He was one of the bosses on the railroad when it first came out to here. And they had some shanties built down around Lake Walden, which was handy to the water, source of water that they needed and all. So they used to take a hand car and go back to the nearest place, which was Waltham. And one Sunday they came back and they found the shanty partly dismantled. So my grandfather said to the fellows that stayed with him, come on, we'll find out. It's got to be footprints. So they followed this path into the woods, and as the old people used to say, if anybody wasn't the same as they were, they were a little touched. So the fellow that was living over the woods that was touched in his head had absconded some of this wood. So they told him to bring it back, and the oil would get the cat in the wood and put it back. So they had to bunk in with somebody that night because they were place was really unlivable. And that fellow happened to be Henry David Thoreau. Now, my mother's aunt lived with us for years until she passed away. And she was the one that told me that. And being such a gracious old lady, I don't think there would be any point in telling me, making a thing up, because she wasn't born here. She was born in Waltham. My other grandfather, M.T. Conley, came over here from Ireland at 13 years old, and he went out in a gold rush covered wagon out to California, and he had a partner, and they had made out fairly well, and evidently my grandfather had a little ESP or something else like that, and his partner said to him one day, "M.T., what seems to be the trouble with you today? The last couple of days you haven't said too much." He said, "I got a funny feeling we ought to sell." And he said, "Why? After all, we've really make it all right with this." And he said, "Well, no, I have a funny feeling." So after a couple of days, the partner said, "Well, you haven't made it missed yet. I think we will sell." So they sold, and my grandfather came home by ship around South America. And so 2 months afterwards, water got into the mine and was bought out by a syndicate. In those days, they didn't have pumps and things like that. But he did have quite a few nuggets that he had around the house. And Waltham Watch was made in, over the Chalice River, and they had a large factory there. Also the Howard Watch, but Howard never said Waltham on it because it would be in competition with Waltham. So it said, if you see an old Howard Watch, you'll see Boston Mass on it. So he said to me many a time, "Well, this watch is going to be yours," and he had it. The movements made over there, and gold out of his, that he had himself out of the case, and he used to take a key out of his pocket and wind that, but evidently my mother's aunt decided she'd keep it, and so I never didn't receive it at all. But he built the first building over what they call the river. The main part of Waltham is what they call the Mercantile Building, or along by City Hall. So he built the first building over there, and for years Clifford S. Cobb had it, and then there was a lease, a 20-year lease, and the estate had leased it to, with a stipulation that they could buy it from Grover Crone, and that was that block there, the first block over the river.
The Concord Minutemen and its formation has been a very cherished project of yours, hasn't it?
Well, yes. Jason Correll conceived it would be a good idea for the anniversary to have a group to participate in the celebration. So the group of us got together, and we decided that best thing to do is to have what they'd call like a drumhead election. So it was early in the spring, and it was flowering and snow and
what year was
grand.
This?
It was 1963. And so we met over the Colonial Inn, and being a veteran, we carried the only colors available, Legion colors, and we farmed over there, and Jason said that the Lynn Village drum, a colonial group, wouldn't match because they had the real heads on the drums and they didn't want to have them wet. And we could ride over to the Veterans Bureau, and I said, "Come on, we've been wet before, let's match." So the group was went over there, and we farmed the Concord Minutemen at that time. And General Whitney was the presiding officer, and they had an election, and Doc McDonald nominated me to the on the executive board. So then we formed the articles and you might call it constitution, what each officer should do and all. In the meantime, the women, headed by Ralph Haskell and Joan Reynolds, whose husband is a great-great-great-grandson of Paul Revere, started this group and so on, along with Ellie McPhillips and women that would participate in it, and Fletcher Adams, his wife. And they found these authentic we formed, we matched the first time just with black pants and white shirts, and then we got the uniforms and we had the group outfitted, and all these women did the sewing. Well, the following year they decided they had enough of the sewing, so we would have to take it on from there. And the first election, Dave Niles, which later designed, and we have patent, the flag of the Concord Minutemen, or an emblem similar to that, there's a patent on that. We had a patent lawyer by the name of Ralph Cadwalder, and he patented Forrest. Well, to fill the position, they talked me into getting taking the position of quartermaster. Well, I went up to Dave Niles' house, and they had a bag of patents and said, well, this is this and this is that. And being a construction worker, I knew, the only thing I knew was one end of the needle from the other. Well, I dug right in, and then we found out we're losing suppliers of material. So I went different places and purchased it. Now, Joan Reynolds had carried us for almost over a year on her personal checking account of $500-some-odd for materials she bought from a store in Boston by the name of Thresher's. So from that time on, I finally had to get the best material made up special from a mill over in Methuen. And that source ran out, and I had to get in touch with a fellow that was the vice president of the clothing outfit down the southern part of the state, and they call it College Clothes or Panther. That's the name of the company they manufacture for other companies. And he went up in Maine on business, and he got me other material. So we had the problem with the pant material, and finally I went to the head of the union, Joe Salerno, which lived in Concord, and he gave me the name of a Bob Asher, which owns Asher Slacker up in Fitchburg. And from that time on, we purchased 200, whatever came in the boat, and it was built to Asher, and that's why we tried to keep the uniform material cost so everybody can get into it. The problem was with later on was with the shirt material, which is unbleached cotton, and of course they gave us the answer that the cotton was not available. Well, the cotton was available, but due to the fact of all the synthetics coming in, the companies got rid of their machines. And when they found out, when the Arabs and the people from the other Philippines, from the hot climate countries, could not stand this new type of material, they went back to it. So now unbleached cotton is available, because the fact is that they even have to put it in the polyester and everything, because it was unbearable through the warm months of the year. I enjoyed very much having people come to the house. I used to deliver the material, cut it up in different lengths, put the patterns all together in the bag, all the buttons and the snaps for the shirt. And I had bags made, shoulder bags. Now this bag is a really authentic bag. Dave Niles went down to the Antiquarian Society to see what type of bags they had at the time when we started this. So the lady down there in charge said, well, please don't handle it too much because the sewing is falling apart from the age of it. So Dave, being a member of the association, had permission to take that bag, make a pattern out of it, and we had them sewed by machine instead of hand. That shoulder bag, it's made of three or four parts. The back and the flap is the same piece. Now, the middle is a gusset, and that's cut out, and the face on the front. The strap also has a buckle on it, like a harness buckle would be. That buckle is very hard to get at this time, but there's two little tabs sewed onto the shoulder to hold the powder horn. In some cases of pictures that we've seen, have had the powder horn tied on, some didn't. It depends upon who they were. And it's very interesting to know that they had two types of powder horn. The powder horn, the small one, contained the fine powder, which was put in the pan. Of course, by putting it in the pan, you had to bring the lock down to hold it. And it was better to load the musket up and put the ball in and ram the ball with thing attached to the musket. Well, that musket was a 69 caliber, and everybody would say to us afterwards, how come that they have to reload all the time, you know, that they couldn't quite understand. Well, everybody had this, nobody had the advantage. Everybody had a musket, but they did come into a musket later on with the down in Pennsylvania, and it's a known fact that they had made grooves in their rifle after it was made, and these balls that would be fired from these muskets would, what we call lobe fall, where this other would just spiral out. And when Washington took command in Cambridge, he had his first call was for Pennsylvania riflemen, and that's why we had the advantage over it. But the 69 caliber with a long barrel was used mostly. The shorter barrel later on was used for the woods and be able to, and it was always pegged over a fireplace where it was always dry. And the larger horn carried the powder that you put in the barrel. Now that, after you loaded, you put your load of powder and your ball and ram it down, usually the fine powder went in the pan, and when you brought that back and you pulled the trigger, the trigger would go up against that pan, and the sparks would fall into the pan, ignite that powder, and there was a hole there. They call that the touch hole. That would go through there and explode. And by doing that, the ball would go, depends upon the load you put in as far as the thing would travel. And that that was the only thing they really had until they came to a percussion cap. But, I got through a year ago after being quartermaster, and this group, it's fantastic. We've had fellows in there, well, I was a construction worker, there was an 18-wheeler truck driver. We had doctors in there, Dr. Gilroy, and Dr. Hulk, and Dr. McDonald, and also the veterinarian, and head of corporations, and our families would go on trips, and we participated in two inauguration parades, and that was, the pictures were taken by the paper, local paper here, of everything being lined up, and of course the women were so.
This was Nixon and Carter, the inaugural.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then we had Bill Dolan, seems to be the fellow that would get everybody together, make all the reservations. So we were not subsidized by anybody. We went and participated. We paid for our meals and lodging and bus transportation. And of course, later on, the airplane, the flights that were, when we went down to the Orange Bowl and participated down there at the opening of the Bicentennial, that we were received with open arms, because the fact was they had heard so much about us. And we had, after we got down there, we went by one full bus, and then we had a 747 full of the people that came down by the plane. And so when we were going around, there was four or five buses full all the time. And we went to St. Augustine before that. At halftime, we participated with Anita Bryant. And we had pretty good coverage on from Concord. And it seemed every place we went, everybody knew Concord. And I think because the fact was that like in the case of Disney World, when two fellows go and load the buses, they said, "Oh, gee, we can't take care of that." And I said, "The only thing for you to do is just stand there and you watch what will happen." Well, Frank Cannon and his son and a few more of them loaded the buses and everything else, and they said it was the first time it was ever done down there in Disney World. So you see that it's a great group, and we look forward to participate in different things that came up. Of course, there was some talk about Concord being high hat, and I think it was unwarranted, because the fact was, it was unbelievable the invitations we got at an executive board meeting. And if you took one too far in advance, you'd run into the problem of something close to home, and they would criticize you for not going close to home where you went further away. And I think the most impressive place that we've ever participated on a small scale is the Cortland, New York. Now, the Cortland is down in the valley, and it's all farms, and the fairgrounds that they had, that building was built over 100 years ago and still intact. They keep it up, and they have different things during the year. Well, they paid our transportation down there, and it had rained for 7 days, and they anticipated another washout. Well, we always try to bring good weather with us, so the result was we were down there. Well, when they paid, after we got through, they had a chicken barbecue for all of us, and we had to, because in that time, we had to pay for our wives, but we didn't have to pay for ourselves. But in the field, which I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of people were on watches, that they played the national anthem in the end, and I looked around, which I try to do all the time, to get the facial expression of the people watching, and the result was that everybody stood up and put their hand over their heart, except three people in wheelchairs, and they could not stand up. And we spoke to the people afterwards about it, and I think it was something in the paper about it. So try to keep the spirit alive, and it gives you a chance to, well, you might call it meditate, to figure out just what those poor people went up after. And then if you read a little more into the history, you'll find out that when they brought the tall ships here to Boston, the people were sitting in warm cars and warm buildings looking outside. And those same tall ships had pulled into New York, and that would scare anybody, and they did not retreat. And that was where one of the worst prison ships that I can think of ever anchored, where the only way they ever got off the ship was to take the dead off and bury them on land, and that was something terrible. So it gives you really a chance to appreciate what our grandparents and the people before them have done along that line to make this country the way it is. And it kind of makes me angry at times to hear people criticize this country. And being in World War II, traveling almost around the world, I traveled all the Atlantic Ocean, up into Russia, up in the Barents Sea. I've been in England, France, and Wales, and the Philippines, and Midway, the Blue Islands, through the Salula Sea and the South China Sea, and places like that. And what little they have to put up with and what we have, it seems the older you get, during some part of the day, you count your blessings. And I always feel that way, and thank the good Lord to be able to live as long as I have, and do as much as I can do for anybody. So,
thank you.